The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. Welcome. I'm Stephanie Contouris with my host, Dave Willingham, Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson, and tonight guest host, Eddie Ury, who is the program manager from Resources for Sustainable Communities. Eddie, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Our pleasure. We have so much to talk about, especially with resources in the House, some stuff about clean energy alternatives and crude oil exports, what's happening in Tacoma, who are water warriors, and we will get to that. But first, let's talk about what happened this week at City Hall and the wrap-up of the homeless camp and protest. The permit ran out at noon on Monday, and Mayor Kelly Linville, who had spoken with people there before, she agreed to work with people and the local homeless folks. She urged them and the activists to reach out and incorporate legislators from Whatcom County as well. She also urged the activists to reach out to local faith communities, which she said had more leeway to offer their property. She suggested working with private businesses as well and said that Bellingham could partner with them and provide garbage pickup and portable toilets.
Right. And, the interesting postscript to the City Hall campout was that the people that had camped there and volunteers used the extra time to clean the site, make sure there was no litter or anything like that. And I went over there myself and looked, and you could hardly tell, other than for a little muddiness, you could hardly tell that there had been a campsite there for 18 days. So I think that speaks really highly of the people that both were camping on city property and the people who organized it, that they did not leave any externality that would undermine, I think, that their case that, we're dealing with a humanitarian issue and a humanitarian cause.
I think that's an excellent point. And the fact that they asked for and received a permit to do this, not that all protests should need a permit, and that's a whole other issue that we've had before in the show, but they did ask for a permit. They were granted a permit, which is, kudos to Bellingham for granting the permit. And they left when the permit was over. There were a lot of people who didn't even know this protest happened. There was a whole media or lack of media component to this campaign protest, which was frustrating. We talked about that last week. But there were people who were shocked and horrified and had really no idea that people are living like this every day, even though people hear the word homeless, people see the numbers of how many people are homeless or how many people with children are homeless. It was very impactful to be reminded visually.
Yeah, I think, there were a lot of people during the 18 days that showed up at City Hall during the public comment period and made the council aware of what the issues were and why the people were camped there. So there was an interaction. I think the one thing that could have happened that did not happen was nobody actually asked the Bellingham City Council officially if they might consider extending or allowing that camp to remain on city property through the holiday, through the first of the year. The appeal was, to my knowledge, never made, actually, that can we do this? And so it became an administrative decision on behalf of the city, and the city followed its own ordinance on this, apparently. I mean, the city had rules about how long the permit could be in force. They had had extra police security around the site, both to protect the people that were there and also to keep any sort of protest or anything like that from fanning out. But I don't think that city council was officially brought into the discussion, and I think that was a shame.
Yeah, and we're simple creatures. If we can ignore a problem, we will ignore a problem. And I think this is a good example of people stepping up and making it a problem for more people and making people pay attention to it. And I I got to say, I liked the city's response, the statement from the mayor. It was technocratic, factual. This is what the situation is. This is what we hope to have going moving forward. And I really hope that the city takes this opportunity to make updates like this on a regular basis. I would like to see this is where we are in working with faith communities and working with businesses. This is, you know, what has been done.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I guess the way I would characterize that or phrase that is the mayor controlled the narrative. And I think that there's another narrative, and there are many narratives, you know, about homelessness in Bellingham. But I think she did a pretty good job of making the case that she had reached out to the faith-based community. They had considered these other options, and these were the issues involved with the other options. It did make the case that the city would be a partner in a private solution if such a thing were to be proposed, sort of laid out that the city does not do sweeps of these camps or drive these people out, you know, in some kind of disorderly, you know, police action. So I think she did, you know, she definitely did damage control on this.
Absolutely. And, you know, what leapt into my mind hearing that was, you know, the one time that I remember in Bellingham having that sort of action was the end of her predecessor's term when they had the police break up the Occupy camp down at the waterfront.
Correct. And you know, that was not handled well. And the reason it wasn't handled well was when the hour came for those people to be moved out, they actually were trying to do a cleanup of their occupied site, and the police came in and just basically bulldozed them out of there. A mess was left behind, but it wasn't a mess that was left behind because the occupiers themselves weren't trying to do something. It's just a deadline came, and then the bulldozer showed up. So I think that was an unfortunate reaction by the previous administration. I think maybe the current administration maybe learned some lessons from that,
or maybe it's just a different administration.
It might be.
You know, that's again a whole nother conversation. So Tim, you've said several things, and Dave that I want to unpack. We'll get to the sweeps in a minute, but you brought up an excellent point about narratives. Last week, we complained bitterly and loudly, some of us, that the Herald had not covered the story at all, and lamented that, and talked about how plug opportunity here. We talked about how we had brought up the story and how Community Voice, our other political affairs program brought to you by Community to Community Racial Justice Coalition and others, had brought up the story on their show, and that these perspectives are not getting heard, and a lot of these stories aren't getting heard. So please, if you're listening and you care about us, give us some end-of-the-year funds to keep us alive, savekmre.org. That's savekmre.org. But one thing, and I'm just going to cop to it now, one thing we didn't do is we didn't get Homeless Voices on the air, and Community Voice didn't get Homeless Voices on the air, as far as I know, and the Bellingham Herald didn't interview anybody. They were out there for at least a half hour on Monday, if not longer. And it's great that they got Kelly Linville's statement, but I would have liked to see any of us, including us, hear from the people who are the most impacted. One of the activist phrases that is increasingly being used in Whatcom County and around the nation is nothing about us without us. And I think that we all need to take that to heart a lot. And then I want to respond to the issue Kelly Linville's speech, and yes, I think there were good things about it. I did speak with Amy Glasser just before we went on the air, and her response to Kelly's speech was that she says she and the other organizers had already tried other churches. They feel jerked around. They feel that the city spends $5 million a year on homeless, and they're missing the mark. And they are not addressing the people who will not or cannot go to shelters. And they're still asking, she says, for city land or place for people to have a more semi-permanent camp, at least through the cold winter months. So that is the other perspective.
Yeah. Well, there are, like I say, there are many perspectives.
And other perspectives.
And I think she raised a some great points. One of the things that happened, I think, in the 18 days was that this was a much more organized kind of camp out than a lot of homeless camps are, which is are sort of just ad hoc. Mm-hmm. And they just form where they can form. Here there was an opportunity for the public, had they chosen to talk to the people. They were there. They were in a safe environment. They were not being driven out or asked to leave that space for those 18 days of the protest. So it was an opportunity for the public to speak to the homeless.
Right. And I saw several people who did. My friend Judy was out there on Monday, and I really appreciate it. She told me that she spent a lot of time talking to people and getting to know people. The Raging Grannies. Let's hear it for the Raging Grannies. They were out there singing and also some local businesses. I can't give shout outs to them because we're a nonprofit, but the local businesses who did send food and pizzas, and there were some good hearted people. I think Amy Glasser's point stands that it's not enough. But let's move on to the sweeps, because there were signs up all over the camp that said stop the sweeps. And Mayor Linville says that there aren't sweeps. In an earlier local news story, I think that they reported as of April, the city has removed almost 430 camps at nearly 300 places around Bellingham. I think the difference in the word sweeps, as far as I understand it, is that the mayor and the city are not considering it a sweep because they give people notification. And to them, a sweep is coming in and kicking everybody out without any kind of notice or without any kind of services. But again, speaking for a group that is not my group, I think if you live in a certain place and then you're asked to leave the place, it's going to feel like a sweep whether the city considers it a sweep or not.
Right, and I think you said it exactly right, which is it really depends on what the definition of sweep is. I think in the minds of many people, when you say sweep, it means, you know, you suddenly, you know, police descend on an area and they rough people up and they move them along and all that. And you know, the city has worked with its homeless outreach team, the HOT team, you know, on a different paradigm where people are notified even up to 14 days in advance that this camp is going to be removed. Whether or not that's never a satisfactory answer, because none of these people have anywhere to go. So to tell them that they, you know, have 48 hours to leave is not. That's a hard option for anybody that has nowhere else to go. So,
I mean, even if you're a tenant in a rental unit, you are supposed to get, 20 or 30 days legally.
Right.
So, I mean, and that's for people who have a bed and have a shower.
And maybe, have a lease.
Right, and have a lease. So 48 hours for somebody who doesn't have those resources seems particularly cruel.
Yeah, and it doesn't – if I'm not mistaken, I don't think that the city has been doing a 48-hour – thing. I think they've been doing more like a 7-day notice.
But still.
Yeah.
Well, I think you both touched on it. The entire situation is still fundamentally unjust. It doesn't matter if it's 2 weeks, doesn't matter if it's a month. You know, these are folks who don't have somewhere else to go. And the expense of, you know, going and doing the cleanup and, you know, managing all of this and keeping track of who's been notified and who hasn't is non-trivial. This is not a minor issue. And, you know, I really respect Amy Glasser's position that you were talking about having a permanent encampment site. I have been to semi-permanent encampment sites, and that has a lot of its own issues. If it's city property, then there are city obligations that come with that. And it's the sort of thing that if you want it, you have to be working at it, and it's going to take a long
constantly,
time.
Constantly. Eddie?
So, I mean, it seems like common sense, right, that the approach of criminalizing homelessness and investing our public funds into just chasing around people who have nowhere to go it's not a sustainable solution. It's not effective. It's not cost effective. And it's unjust. Housing issues and homelessness, there are systemic things there that maybe the local government can't just so easily solve 100%, but there's certainly better approaches on the table. With the encampment in front of City Hall these last few weeks, I think what we've seen is the city and the general public were being forced to confront this, something that we're always everyone's aware of. But also it's given an opportunity, I think, for, like you said, the voices of the people experiencing this problem in the most real way to actually be heard. I was at the city council public hearing a couple weeks ago, and it was remarkable actually to see a venue where many of the people who are encamped out in front of City Hall were there testifying directly and asking for the most basic requests of things the city could do, like just having a place to use a bathroom publicly safely, or a portable toilet, or having a place to leave belongings and not have them be swept away and taken away by police. And like the most basic things were some, even if not even asking for housing to be provided, right? And there's just, so I mean, that's not easiest use to solve, but I think it's come to the forefront. We got to keep pushing on it. So
I think that that's one of perhaps the most effective things. And there were a lot of effective things about this protest. And not that it's up to me to rate the protest, but man, I have to walk away with a huge thumbs up, even if the problems aren't solved, even if we haven't made a lot of progress. But the visibility and the impact of the visibility, and hopefully it is a far-reaching impact because the problem did not go away just because the people did. But one thing when legislators cry about, well, I don't hear from those people a lot, whatever the situation is, there's a missing piece. And the missing piece is people don't always have the ability to reach out or go to city council meetings. Sometimes people are poor and they're working and they have to take care of their kids. Or sometimes people are homeless. And no, you may not be able to get from wherever you are to City Hall. And the fact that people were there this week and they were able to do that, that's a really positive outcome. So so the sweeps or not sweeps, the camp cleanups, depending on how you look at it, the city of Bellingham has wrestles with a real problem in this area. And I think that they have made it clear that the times that they clean up areas are usually city parks or rivers or places where a congregation of people and the output of a congregation of people has a greater impact on the environment, polluting the waters or polluting areas and making things difficult. I don't know if I was mayor, which thank God I'm not, but I don't know how you resolve that issue.
Well, you know, the most visible public response to homelessness actually arrived out through the Parks Department, of all places. I mean, of all the city departments that you would imagine would be impacted and it would have to respond, it was through the Parks Department, and they were doing, creek bed restorations. They were managing parks. They were coming across needles and trash and things like that. And this was several years ago, before you really saw the explosive impacts of homelessness. And so that was on Bellingham. And so you had that sort of environmental response. The Parks Department were not, those people, they had not signed up to be social workers. And so that was the genesis, I think, of the HOT team, the homeless outreach team, and that program to try to go out and reach.
And that's a city program.
That's a city program to try to reach these homeless communities because parks personnel are not trained to do so. And so to have a mechanism that could happen. So you had an environmental component to it early on. But I think a lot of what we've seen happening is now that the construction industry has been resurrected in Bellingham and there's a housing shortage, apparently, or a claimed housing shortage. There's lots of greenfield development going on in Bellingham, and those used to be places where people could have a camp, and those places are being moved out. And I don't know that the city has a role or has much of a role in moving those camps out, but those camps are obviously being moved out. One very large camp was down around where the Lincoln Street Transit Center is around the university, and all that housing went in there, and that displaced a lot of people who had been living there for a long time.
It goes back to the beginning of this conversation when the mayor said, well, what about faith communities? To my knowledge, no faith community has taken her up. They have different ordinances, like you said. Granting an extended ordinance would be difficult, if not impossible, for the city. But churches and places of faith don't have those same constraints. So she said, reach out to them. What about the rest of the county? Like, where are the other voices in this? My sense is that she's feeling like everybody's like, pointing a finger at her, you need to deal with all of this. And yet, Amy Glasser and some of the organizers are saying, but the city does spend $5 million. And so where do you folks see the responsibility between being the mayor and being private industry? And
well, I think that the mayor is correct. There are a lot of players in this that are not being directly addressed. And I also think that part of that is on the mayor. And that's a administrative problem that we need someone with administrative skills to start working on. I don't think it's solely on the city of Bellingham to solve what is a national crisis. And but I think that the city can take the lead in leaning on the county, and the city can work with faith groups in a more direct way than individual homelessness activists can.
Well, I think you were right. We talked about it on this show last spring when the mayor reached out to the Port of Bellingham and asked for them to be a partner in homelessness, and they told her to shove it, essentially. And then she is kind of trying to do the same thing with the county. And the county really doesn't want to deal with this particular issue at this time because they are trying to be, I think, strategic about how they use county land inside the city of Bellingham, or how they withhold it or do not allow it to be used for particular purposes. She's asked, she wanted to work with St. Joe's on maybe using the old St. Luke's Hospital
South
facility.
Campus,
it's
yeah.
like, shove it. You know?
Really? I never heard that.
Well,
St. Joe's?
Well, basically, yeah. It's their property and,
which is vacant, right?
Yeah. And you go out to the faith-based organizations, attest to a certain kind of value about the hungry and the homeless, and they're not willing to step up. So, I would be a little frustrated, too, if I were the mayor, because, the city needs to take the lead, but it needs to have partners step up.
And let me just say... I never thought I was going to stand here being in defense of faith communities, but here I am. First of all, a lot of faith communities, even if they are not offering their property, do a lot in terms of feeding homeless every week. And there's a new program coming in where they're going to house a few families, not enough, but housing 12 families a year, and then providing services. And I also want to give out a shout out to UCC, the United Congregation on Cornwall, that is using their entire basement to build a day shelter for homeless youth specifically up until the ages of, I think, 26 or so, which is an area of the homeless population that is specifically threatened, but also doesn't have anywhere to go. And yes, there are faith communities are doing something. On the other hand, maybe not offering somebody's property for a homeless camp is a little NIMBY.
Well, again, there's no individual faith community in Whatcom County or Washington State that can solve this, that can really provide a solution to it. But I think that if we got a couple of people working together, we could do something a lot better than what's happening now. And this is going to be a marathon. Whatever happens, it's not going to be enough until it is, and it's going to be a long time getting there. Eddie, you mentioned public toilets. Twice in my life, I have lived in a city that made a big deal out of, we have put in these public toilets. One time there were these, fabulous
self-showering Seattle toilets.
And, They were up there for a while. People started sleeping in them. They're like, oh, well, we got to get rid of the toilets. That's not the problem.
Right.
The problem is those people didn't have anywhere else to go. But
right.
there weren't people pushing for it anymore. And so it kind of got to go away. And I will point out, people do not stop going to the bathroom if there aren't public toilets. This is not a problem that solves itself.
We live close to downtown. Yep. This happens on our street for sure. Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point. And I think one thing that we're not, there's so many different communities that the homeless community is really several communities. And one thing that I think about is when we're talking about people who are dealing with mental health issues, and the answer is, no, I'm not saying the answer should be tiny homes necessarily, but the answer is, well, let's put everybody in a room, whether it's a winter shelter or it's the Lighthouse Mission. I can imagine having anxiety and paranoia and terror and not being able to be in a room with 200 people. And maybe that's why people were in showers. So maybe we need temporary shower / places to sleep. But that does lead me to bring up that the city is asking for our help. And they've got a survey out, and we put it on our Facebook page. We will put it on our website. But you can go right now to Cascadia News Now on Facebook and see the city's survey. They're asking about housing and homelessness. They really want our input, and who can blame them? These are huge issues that are very knotted and difficult, and they're related. In terms of homelessness, they have questions like, should we focus more on emergency shelter, transitional housing, rent vouchers, single room occupancy? In terms of services they provide, is job training more important? Is are different agencies working together better? Our mental health? And we are all one community to that sense. We all live here, regardless of the status of where we sleep. And so let's all get together and at least take the time to weigh in on the survey. Again, you can find it on Cascadia News Now on Facebook.com. And I really urge you to weigh in on this.
Well, I think this is a continuation. You know, the city did its priority survey last year, and they found that, you know, the top three issues for Bellingham were income security, housing security, and homelessness. And all of those things are one triangle. Each one of them is a point on a triangle, and they're all talking about the same thing. So you could say that the city is attempting to follow up on
that. Drill down a little bit more.
But I think the city also is, I think they're trying to frame the debate a little bit, because, you know, I know that a lot of the calls that come into City Hall are get rid of these people, drive them out of town, you know, put them in jail, hit them with clubs if you have to, just get them off our streets, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the city is like, look, let's have a discussion about what are our real and true and humane options. And out of those that are on the table, which do you prefer? So I think that it's not just a way of trying to get more information from the public, but I think it's also a way of trying to frame the debate that, no, we're not going to jail these people. That's not going to be the solution to homelessness.
And also, why don't you have a better solution?
Well, and, you know, I just want to say, if I were mayor,
maybe you should be.
Let's all be glad that I'm not. But if I were mayor, this is the sort of thing that would keep me up at night every night, because this is a problem that we are kind of at the precipice that looks like it's going to get much worse. You know, the federal government is radically restructuring the way it raises and spends money, and Washington State gets a third of its budget from the federal government. You know,
so far,
there's a lot that's changing in our corner. You know, Alaska is in the middle of a 25-year experiment on just how little can we pay on public services, and this is the sort of thing that looks like it's going to get bad before it gets better. So, you know, I'm glad to see the city being a little bit proactive and being kind of out front with it, even though, as I said before, it's not enough.
And we've talked about this on the show before, but, you know, there are many programs that have housed people in the city. There's one group of people that aren't easily housed. They're the ones that that aren't in a program. They're the ones that haven't committed to sobriety or no drug use, and they do cause external problems on a community, because they can be rowdy, they can be disruptive, and so what we're really talking about in this particular thing are the people that don't easily fit into any other sort of program. The kind of the hardest nut to crack is the one that we're talking about here.
Absolutely. You are listening to Cascadia News Now. That was Tim Johnson's voice from the Cascadia Weekly. Dave Willingham and Eddie Urey from Resources is here. You are tuned to KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt. I do want to say, I acknowledged earlier that we hadn't spoken to people who are directly impacted by this, and we plan to do so in January. So stay tuned. This issue is not going to go away, and we're not going to go away, and we're going to keep talking about it and getting different voices to weigh in. Before we move on to some of Eddie's big issues in terms of the environment, Kelly Linville did say reach out to the county council, and the county council will be different as of January, including one slot. We don't know who is going to fill it, and that's because Todd Donovan ran for and won a seat in the new redistricted district, and that leaves a vacancy. Tim, do you want to give us a little update on who is a contender?
Well, it's a big list. I think there might be 26 people on that list now. And it's, I guess if I would frame it, it's people that want the job and want to run for the office. And if I'm just going to characterize it if I can and put them in quadrants, but people that want the job and want to run for the office next year, and then there are the people that want to take it on as a caretaker role. So that's a decision that the council would have to make. Somebody, you know, do we want to leverage anybody into that position by appointing them now, or do we want to keep that a viable race in November? That's one facet of it.
Then let me just stop you and say, so the appointed position will only be January till November of 2018.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. And then the other facet are there are a lot of people who have served in governmental roles who are willing to step in. Some, I think, to leverage themselves, and some as caretaker. For example, there are ex-county council people that have applied. Kathy Kirshner has applied. Seth Fleetwood has applied.
No Carl Weimer, Emily though.
Weaver. Emily Weaver has applied. On the city of Bellingham, Stan Snapp, who served on Bellingham City Council, he's applied. Tim Ballou, who was the chairman for Lummi Business Council, he has applied for the position. Mm-hmm. And then there are really some fabulous resumes coming in from people who have served in those sorts of roles through the university, from business. I mean, it's fabulous how many people stepped up to this. I just wish those people would step up during an election too.
Right? Oh my God, where are these people when they could just run
to be
for
fair,
it.
Seth Fleetwood has run pretty frequently,
right.
And he
some
did
have
a heroic
yes.
job
Certainly.
Running against Doug Erickson.
Right, and some of them have, and those would be the people. And I think for the most part, I can't say this for absolutely certain, but I think for the most part, most of the ex-council people are those people that, hey, I've done my time, but I wouldn't mind sitting in for 11 months and until a new person comes on board.
I don't see Stan Snapp necessarily running in November.
No, Stan. Yeah, Stan is one of those caretakers. Seth is definitely a caretaker. I think Tim Ballou would be a caretaker.
Unfortunate. I would love to see Chairman Tim Ballou be a longtime county councilor.
And, of course, he's not the only tribal member that's applied either. I think Aaron Thomas also applied. So mm-hmm. there's another. So, I mean, it's a big, beautiful list. I don't envy the county council for having to go through that list and try to pick who they think would be best, because there are a lot of great names on that list.
And Natalie McClendon, chair. She's currently on the Planning Commission for the county, but she was a chair of Whatcom Dents for a very
Correct.
Long time. Not pictured is Amy Glasser, who a lot of people are jonesing for her to be the temporary appointment, but I think she did not apply.
And to my knowledge, she did not apply. It's interesting because perhaps she should have applied, and perhaps Rebecca Boonstra, who did not win in the District 3 race, she could have applied as well.
Oh, right.
So that would have been great.
But
trying to put myself in their shoes, I would think that the person that I would want would have a lot of experience, so they could hit the ground running, and would not want the job as a permanent position, so that you're not unfairly disadvantaging somebody that would like to run for that position in November. So if I were them, I would look at people who have a lot of experience in councilmanic activities, who are familiar with county issues and the things that they're going to be dealing with this year, and who have no long-term aspiration for the position. So I would think that you could probably sort through these and maybe get down to about nine names out of these.
Okay, come on, tell us your favorite. Who's your favorite?
Well, do I have to?
Yes.
I actually think that they have an incredible opportunity with Tim Ballou, who just came off of chairman of Lummi Nation, They're going to be dealing with the Cherry Point plan. They're going to be dealing with water issues. And, of course, you know, Lummi is a gigantic, has a gigantic water right.
Have we ever had somebody from Lummi on the county council?
I don't
know
that we've had Lummi. Lummi have actually run for the position, but we've had Nooksack. We've had Bob Kelly. Yeah. So we've had tribal members on the council. I just think it's a unique opportunity to bring somebody that's really familiar with these issues that they're going to be dealing with, but from a different perspective, and have him on there for a brief time.
Dave, Eddie, any favorites?
Well, I think we'd be honored to have Tim Blue II serve on the county council. Certainly unusual for the leader of a sovereign tribe to be joining a local government body. There's an interesting list there, though. I think, certainly it'd be nice to see the county council appoint a woman and have some more balance. And so I sort of expected that they would. But, with Tim there, though, it'll be interesting to see what they pick.
Well, you know me. I want somebody who's a, podium banging, screaming something. Just somebody who's really passionate
about
something.
Why aren't you running? You bang a podium now and then.
No, it's just exhausting. And I don't like that room. But the, I really think that, Tim, I like the idea of picking somebody who is a, placeholder, who is experienced and, committed to those issues and can really hit the ground running. This is a real opportunity to pick somebody who maybe isn't going to run for this seat, but is going to run for something else. This is a great prestige and public exposure opportunity for the right person. And yeah, I'm really glad I don't have to pick.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you have any influence or not, but hey, write to your current county council members if you have an opinion and let them know, and we'll see if they listen. But we've got to move on. We have a lot to talk about in terms of energy and the environment with Eddie Ury.
Let me see if I can find something that we can maybe launch this discussion on, which was the story that was in the Spokesman Review this week that basically estimated that 1 million barrels of oil had come into the state from on rail traffic. Are you familiar with that story? And I mean, what it speaks to in my mind is the tremendous even though a lot of these projects have not pushed forward, there's still a tremendous volume of this energy coming into Washington.
True. Actually, for the first time now, we're seeing public disclosure to know the amount of oil that's moving through Washington State. Because of some legislation we were able to pass a couple of years ago. We're seeing over 1 million, roughly averaging 1 million barrels a week coming in by rail, and more so than ever before coming in by pipeline. The Puget Sound pipeline that's owned by Kinder Morgan brings what's mostly heavy crude, tar sands, bitumen, unconventional extreme oil source coming to the refineries from Alberta, Canada. There's, of course, four oil refineries in our local neck of the woods, two at the Cherry Point area, two down in Anacortes and March Point, and there's another one down in Tacoma. It brings a lot of public health and safety risks and hazard to having this increased, we've seen oil trains exploding across the country in recent years. It's a very new method of transporting oil by rail. Only in the last 4 years has this even existed. We're also seeing, overall, it's concerning because as we're reducing our demand for petroleum products, there's actually been a trajectory of decline in demand for the last 5 years domestically, even with growth of the economy and population. We can expect that is going to accelerate with the electrification, alternative transportation, but there's a huge glaring concern we have around as we transition our economy and no longer have reliance on these fuels, will they be moving just as much explosive oil by rail, by pipeline, and by tanker through the sensitive ecosystems of the Salish Sea for export overseas? And at the end of 2015, there was a federal ban that was in place for 40 years blocking crude oil export from the U.S., ensuring that oil from the U.S. would be refined here, the jobs would be kept here, so that we could hold them to higher standards, pay workers better, have better set practices for safety, pollution control, that kind of thing. And that ban was lifted so that now it's free game to export America's energy reserves overseas into the global market. And with that comes this great risk. So even as we transition away, we're still going to be bearing all the costs with none of the reward, no response to our demand. So some of what we're working on at Resources and in partnership with other organizations all around the Pacific Northwest is working to stop crude oil export from taking hold long term, preventing that from being allowed.
Well, maybe let me just step back a little bit, because people hear the term resources. A lot of people say resources. Is it the restore? Is it the same thing? Maybe you can just give a little context as to your position, what you do, and what Resources does.
Yeah, sure. Well, Resources is an environmental nonprofit organization based right here in Bellingham. We have membership mostly in Waukaman, Skagit County, and we have a variety of programs. A lot of folks are familiar with the Restore, which diverts reusable building materials from demolition sites and gets them into people's homes, diverts millions of pounds of material from the landfill every year. We have a clean water program that advocates for water quality and quantity issues in Whatcom County. We have educational programs that work in local classrooms, teach youth about sustainability issues. And my program is what we call clean energy. We work to promote an accelerated transition to a clean energy system while opposing new expansions for fossil fuel export that have been targeting our region. So a lot of folks are familiar with the battle over coal export through Cherry Point, which was defeated thanks to Lummi Nation's assertion of their treaty-protected fishing rights in a landmark decision by the Army Corps of Engineers in 2016.
And that's all resolved now, right?
it appears so.
Yeah?
It appears so, yes. There were actually five other proposed coal export terminals that came up at that time just around 2010 to 2012 time period. And all six of those proposed coal terminals have since been defeated. Most recently, the last one left standing was proposed down in Longview, Washington on the Columbia River, and that has actually just had final denial both at the state level and the county level. And so there will be no more coal export moving through Washington. There's still some trains that are moving through up to British Columbia right now. BC is actually taking steps to try to cut off U.S. coal export through Canada. So within a matter of, it looks like possibly by 2020, there will be zero coal trains moving through the state of Washington.
That was the question I was going to ask. Was I wanted you to walk us through some of these other proposals. It's not just coal, though, because there are other ones as well. I mean, there's what's going on with March Point. These are ongoing. I mean, in other words, the war is not won, and I think there might be some complacency from a lot of people that, you know, maybe the worst of this is past, but actually there's a tremendous amount still coming through Washington.
Well, that's why I asked Yeah,
there are still other projects out there. I don't know if you can comment on March Point at all.
Yeah, so we've done a really good job working with organizations, sovereign tribes, labor unions also, working together with environmental groups and communities to stop pretty much all the new proposed projects. There were several proposed oil terminals along with these coal terminals that have all been closed off. The problem is that there's existing infrastructure in place that can be used to export crude oil now that they have at the refineries at March Point, Cherry Point, and at Tacoma. These are marine terminals that handle crude oil. They were built in the 1950s. Most recently, the Cherry Point was built in 1971.
And where's March Point?
That's in Anacortes. Incidentally, both of these locations that have two refineries are also adjacent to Indian reservations. The Swinomish tribe is next to these refineries at March Point, the Lummi Nation next to the refineries at Cherry Point, and land that had actually originally been promised to the tribes in the treaties and then was later industrialized. In a time period where there really was there were very few environmental laws and regulations, they were able to take advantage and develop those areas with very little oversight. And since then, they've actually been able to evade having a lot of regulation and law simply because their uses, their operations were grandfathered in. But what we've been looking at is actually ways to apply existing laws in new ways that can cut off crude oil export even through those existing facilities.
Can you talk at all, like this might lead into this, but the current moratorium on crude exports, Cherry Point, and the, what the county council is trying to do there, and what the timeline is for that, or for that action that they're contemplating.
Yeah, well, the Whatcom County Council is one local government, along with many in the region, that are confronting this issue, and happens to be a place that's most heavily targeted for crude oil export. They, after widespread public insistence around this issue, they took action last year and implemented a moratorium that basically just puts a hold on any new permit applications that would facilitate increased shipment of unrefined fossil fuels through Cherry Point, if they're not for the purpose of, you know, refining and processing there. The thinking being, we are looking at policies that do want to protect refinery jobs, keep refineries there, but not allow expansions to just export it where it can be refined somewhere else cheaper. That actually undermines job security in American refineries. The Oil Refinery Workers Union, the USW, have widely opposed it. So for issues both economic interest for the county and public health and safety, the county took action here. And what they're doing is they've put a pause on permits, right, while they're exploring ways they can take action to protect public health and safety if there are new proposals coming. There are some other things going on in the background there, too, like the potential for a new fracked gas pipeline to move through the Cherry Point through Whatcom County for export via Canada. There's the potential resurfacing of a coal terminal, things like that. The thinking was to get the policies straight before new applications come in. And so the county commissioned a legal study. They hired a law firm to look at what's their powers to deal with this issue. What can they do to protect the public? What's the power of a county? And the results of that are actually going to be coming out and be in front of the council very soon, next month when they reconvene. And it'll also be public in other bodies like local governments in Anacortes, Skagit County, the city of Tacoma are also looking to that study to see what's on the table.
And you are listening to Cascadia News Now. That is Eddie Urey, who is with Resources, his program manager there. And I'm Stephanie Contours, along with Dave Willingham and Tim Johnson. We are going to be right back right after this.
My name's Michael Park, and every week on the International Americana Music Show, I'll be playing a selection of the best Americana music made solely by non-American artists, whether it's alt-country from Australia, newgrass from Norway, or singer-songwriters from South Africa. There'll be music and interviews with Americana artists from a lot of countries that may surprise you. So join me every week for an hour-long musical trip across countries and continents on the International Americana Music Show.
International Americana, Fridays at 8 p.m. and Wednesdays at 10 p.m. on KMRE 102.3 FM.
At Resources, we promote sustainable communities and protect the health of Northwestern Washington's people and ecosystems using science, education, advocacy, and action. We have launched a new project called Washington Goes Solar to help homeowners and businesses learn about current incentives for home and business solar arrays. More information is available on this project and others at re-sources.org.
Hi, I'm Chris Heim, inviting you to join me here on KMRE for a global musical adventure in the Global Village. Each week we explore music from all around the world, from classic recordings to the latest releases, and a wide variety of artists inspired by international sounds. World Music in the Global Village, Saturday nights at 9, here on KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham, your community, your voice, your station.
You are listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Dave Willingham, joined by Stephanie Contreras and Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson and our special guest host, Eddie Urey. Eddie, I want to lead in with a question that you mentioned using existing laws in new ways. Can you give me an example of what you mean by that?
Yeah. So basic laws that were passed in the early 1970s, the Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, at the Washington state level, the Shoreline Management Act is key, that was actually passed by Washington state voters to protect Washington state's shorelines from development and manage them properly, to protect ecosystems, to protect fish habitat, public enjoyment of those shorelines. So a lot of things that were built before passage of those acts might not actually be able to make it through permitting now. They're grandfathered in. But when they apply for upgrades, expansion, say changing their operations and using existing things in new ways, adding on to them, it's an opportunity for us to hold them to a higher standard, to make sure that we're doing the utmost to control pollution, to be safe as possible. Granted, you know, they're going to be doing these operations as long as there's a demand for fossil fuels. So we're actually looking at new ways to apply the Shoreline Management Act that can stop crude oil export. So we're moving forward with actually an appeal of a refinery expansion in Anacortes. And that's going to end up becoming there will probably be a state decision on that that will actually come down and apply to all the refineries in Washington.
So tell us some of the other things that you are passionate about and that you'd like to see change in 2018. If you could wave your magic Enviro wand.
We're really at an exciting point with this Do Your Coming, because we've pretty much, our coalitions are wrapping up all of the major fossil fuel terminal battles that have been on the table. Granted, there's still a few more here and there, and starting to move forward together towards accelerating that transition to clean energy. But doing it in a way to make sure make that transition just and equitable, which means bringing different parties, different stakeholders, impacted communities to the table. So it's been really exciting in the last few years. A great coalition's been built across the state of Washington. It's called the Alliance for Jobs and Clean Energy. And it's...
Who else is in it?
So leaders in the alliance include the Washington State Labor Council, the Washington Environmental Council, community to community here in Bellingham.
Nice.
They all have members serving on the Board of Governance. Our steering committee also, which I serve on, also includes organizations like the Confederated Tribes of the Tulalip, a number of labor unions, the electrical workers, even the building trades are at the table here.
So it's a real blue-green coalition, in other
true,
words.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Right.
And by that, I mean labor and environment, which at least in our county, if not other areas, has been on opposite sides of issues before. And that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, and really no more. Because, I mean, for all the work that's been done to try to drive a wedge between jobs and the environment, we're actually working together on all fronts. And but basically everyone's come together to the same table. Over actually 190 organizations now are members, recognizing that climate change is urgent. We need to take action on it. We need to accelerate this energy transition, but we got to get the policy right. You got to get it right before you move forward with something this big and monumental. So what the framework that we've all negotiated to come to agreement on is to fund solutions by pricing pollution. So to create public investment, basically.
Catchy.
Yeah. you could call it a Green New Deal. Some might refer to it, where we'll take public investment for infrastructure. So creating jobs, building infrastructure that will transition us to clean energy, while also investment that can help us adapt to the impacts of climate change, to our looking at our water resources, managing forests, with forest fires being a huge issue now. Having dedicated funding for all those purposes.
Yeah.
There was an initiative on the ballot a few years back that had a carbon pricing proposal and put that in front of the voters. And one of the statewide, and one of the criticisms of that, and perhaps one of the reasons that it did not pass, was that there wasn't a lot of buy-in from a broad range of stakeholders. Would you say that this group that you're talking about has the sort of the potency and the breadth to bring forward a carbon pricing strategy for Washington?
Yeah, and what's great about it is it's not a group, it's not an alliance in name the way some things say they're an alliance, but this is actually a broad-based coalition. I mean, this is actually all these different groups sitting at a table and talking to each other, right? And sharing and making decisions. And so a lot of care has been taken to arrive at a policy that everyone can support without alienating certain sectors. And so there's been a lot of effort in making sure that leaders from communities of color, that their voices are listened to as key, and that we're getting the policy right. And so that when we move forward, we're moving forward together. We're doing it with the support of everyone at the table.
Yeah.
And that's not what happened with the initiative that went on the ballot before.
And one of the things I think you had a very weighted phrase about the attempts to drive a wedge, because I might argue that that does come from the outside, not that labor issues don't sustain themselves and environmental, but one of the things that's fascinating is this concept that it's environment or jobs, and I think there are voices in our county that are pretty loud when they try to make that point. But I know in solar, for instance, that is one of the biggest job creators in the nation. And I think that there's a story to be told about how energy actually creates more jobs. Clean energy, I mean.
I mean, it's true. Currently, clean energy is employing leaps and bounds more people and more job growth in the United States than fossil fuel industry. Solar alone employs more people than coal, oil, and gas combined. And that those numbers are rapidly growing. We're seeing that growth right here in Whatcom County. iTech Energy opened up a new solar panel manufacturing facility down in the Bellingham Waterfront District, adding new jobs. We have solar installers here that are putting panels on people's rooftops every single day. And they're being made right here in Bellingham. So that work's being done. That's the way that we're going. But it's not happening fast enough. It's a problem of not having enough capital investment up front and having the rate of return happen fast enough for investors to ensure we can drive our economy to be 100% clean energy as fast as we need it to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. So that's why we've developed a way to basically create an investment for that by putting a fee on pollution that can generate this. So
Eddie, obviously, we're going to have you back if you're willing to come back, because I think we've covered maybe 1/8 of the issues and since you're going to have a busy 2018, maybe you'll give us an update. We just have a minute or two left, and Dave, you have a Fergie Love Fest moment for our Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who we love so dearly.
Yes, our Attorney General announced today that the state Attorney General's office is filing suit against Value Village for misrepresenting themselves as a charity organization here in Washington State.
Are they not a charity organization?
They are a private company that is for profits, and they have made deals with local charities and misrepresented those deals and misrepresented their stake in them and how much they were actually giving to those charities. And I was very happy to see some more consumer protection action happening from our state AG.
Fantastic.
Scrooge.
Scrooge and
Mr. Potter are alive and well and operating.
Exactly, but maybe not for long. So all of the issues that we've touched on, we will continue to touch on with your help, because KMRE needs to be self-sustaining. We need to find a new home. Please go to savekmre.org. And also, Eddie, if people wanted to get involved in some of the issues that you're dealing with, where should they go?
Oh, well, you can visit re-sources.org, our local organization, or to learn more about the Alliance, you can visit jobscleanenergywa.com.
And you heard that once, so we will get that on our Facebook page and our website so that you don't have to be scrambling for pen and paper. That's all the time we have now. Huge thanks to our guest host tonight, Eddie Urey.
Hey, it was great to be here. Thank you.
It was certainly great for us, and we need more of it. So please come back. And you have been listening to Cascadia News Now. Our other hosts, Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham, our fantastic engineer who does everything for us on the fly, Devlin Sweeney. Dave Willingham edits the show, and it's produced by me, Stephanie Contouris. And this is Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.